Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's called the Lovejoy Hour, as it's an hour of chat. And I'm Tim Lovejoy. On today's podcast, we'll be traveling into the future with friend of the podcast, Tom Cheesewright, who's a futurologist or a futurist. He predicts the future for a job, which sounds like a great job. If you want to see any stuff he does, by the way, go to tomcheesewright.com and follow him there, where he discusses the future a lot. I love having these conversations. I love trying to work out what is going on in the future for myself. So let's waste no more time. Let's meet him, Tom Cheesewright. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Tim.
You call yourself a futurist, don't you? Not a futurologist.
Yeah, but you know, I'm kind of happy with either. My only differentiation is the ology in futurology. It suggests that somehow we're sort of traveling forward and studying the future, since that's the root of this, of the ology word from Greek. And I don't think it's really a study. It's more of a sort of projection, storytelling with some evidence behind it.
Right. Okay. What do you think is one of the best predictions you've made, do you think?
I guess not so much one I've made, but one that through research I was aware of was the pandemic. So my last book, there is if only a brief reference to this possibility of what the World Health Organization then called Disease X. This possibility they just convened a panel to prepare for and work out how the world should respond should another SARS-like virus start to spread around the world.
So your job is to go into, or one of your main jobs is to go into companies and advise them on what's happening in the future. Did you say to them there could be a chance for a pandemic?
No, because it's very sort of domain specific, my work. So I'm very rarely talking about the future. I'm usually talking about your future, and that your future is often quite narrow. So whether it's a Facebook or a Google or an Audi or a BMW or a bank or whoever it may be, they meet up and say, what are the things that's going to affect our world in the next 5 or 25 years? And obviously sort of health issues come into that conversation, and we talked about pandemics, but there are so many sort of possibilities on that spectrum that you're talking about. That it's really about trying to narrow it down to the ones that have the greatest chance of the greatest impact on their business. And actually, for most of the clients I'd worked with in the last couple of years, although the pandemic has been dramatic in the long-term reality for their business, it probably hasn't done them that much damage.
The world's changed so dramatically. Well, it feels like it's changed dramatically during the pandemic. Are you thriving during this time because there's so much new stuff happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's made the life challenging for sure, because there's so much going on. But the second half of 2020 was an incredibly busy period for me. You know, the first half was a bit weird because a lot of my work is public speaking. You know, people love to get a futurist to come and stand at a conference or come into their company and, you know, shake things up a little bit. And of course, all the conferences and all the company meetings were stopped. But then it sort of got into the halfway through the year and people stopped thinking in pure panic terms and started actually trying to plan for the future. And once they did that, the phone starts ringing. It's like, okay, how do we think about what's going to happen in 2-3 years? How do we scope this out? How do we build more agility? And a lot of my work, the reason I call myself an applied futurist, is not just what it's coming, it's how do we prepare for it and how do we build an organization that can respond to it. So I got pulled into all these conversations about changing organizations, building resilience, building agility for the next time some mad event like a pandemic comes along.
It just seems to me that as a country, you know, as a business, you have to go, right, we need a little bit of money tucked away in case something happens, you know, rainy day money, that sort of thing, in case there's a bit of a problem. And some companies, as a few of my mates have had to close down their companies, they were living to the maximum, their companies were. And I think as a country, we're looking at this, like, obviously the country are trying to help out with a furlough and the NHS is, we've had to build all the nightingales. We are spending a lot of money, and we have to remember the governments don't have any money at all. It's our money they're spending. And I just can't work out where it's all going to come from. And it feels that we might need to think about economics, politics, restructure, because it's going to be a mess after the pandemic's ended, isn't it?
I turn it the other way around. I think we've spent money really badly during the pandemic. I think we need to spend an awful lot more after it. You know, the OECD and the IMF have come out in the last few weeks and said austerity was a disaster. trying to balance the books when things are dire just doesn't work. You just make things worse, basically. I'm paraphrasing, probably going a bit further than what they said. And what you have to do as a government in these scenarios and go, we can't, but we don't have money, but we can create it. And we can create it. And there are some things we need to do if we're going to get through the next 12 months that I think require spending big money. And we know we've got problems to tackle. You know, our infrastructure in this country is crumbling. Our housing estate is desperately poor from an energy efficiency perspective, which is a big problem when everybody's working from home. You know, we know that lots of people don't have access to broadband. So we're having a conversation today about kids struggling to access remote lessons. There are so many things we could sensibly put money into that will have a long-term return. You know, I've just been going back to Mariana Mazzucato's book, The Entrepreneurial State, which, you know, argues, and you know, there are some criticisms of this argument, but argues that so many of the things that have driven financial success, the corporate success in the last 20 years, came from massive state investment, in the internet and the underlying research behind it. You know, I think now's the time to be thinking, okay, what's going to drive the next 20 years, the next 40 years of economic success, and where can we start to invest some money now? Because, you know, we've seen the sort of jobs apocalypse that's happening. It's not going to get any better anytime soon. I think I saw this morning that the GDP forecasts for Q1 for this year for the UK have just been revised down from growth of 0.1%, which was clearly optimistic, down to a contraction of about 2.5%. You know, it's not looking good anytime soon. And I think the only way through that is to throw big money at the problem.
Where does it come from, though, the money?
Well, it's just, it's conjured out of thin air, isn't it?
Magic and, trees.
Yeah, but, you know, you can only tax people who've got money. You can only tax people who've got jobs who are earning money. You can only tax companies who are making profits. And so if you let the situation get so bad that, you know, like your friends, their businesses have folded, you know, like a lot of the retailers have collapsed, like the services industry, food and drink, like those have gone by the wayside, you know, unless you're going to throw big government money into sort of startup capital to get people back off the ground again, unless we're going to borrow huge sums of money from elsewhere, where does the sort of the ability to restore the nation's finances come from? It only comes from a successful and thriving economy. And I think if we let it get too far, and if we don't invest in the underlying infrastructure behind that, there's going to be no base to rebuild from.
I'm going to come back to money in a minute because I've got a question to ask you on it and you might be able to help me. But I just want to pick up on something you said about houses and energy. I have this problem with our country is that we're obsessed with old buildings. Okay, so my house is 100 years old. It's a semi-detached, so I can't knock it down because my neighbors might not like it. I'm attached to them. But in theory, if it wasn't, then the reality is if I tried to knock my house down, they would say, not a chance. It's Victorian. It's listed, da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, I can feel every single time winter comes, it's like this house is leaking energy out of it. And I'm like, no one drives a 100-year-old car. And yet we're expected to live in 100-year-old houses and also go, they're brilliant to look at. And I'm like, well, yeah, well, let's keep the front of them then and then and knock down the rest. We've got this ridiculous situation. I don't know if you know about this in Hammersmith. We've got the Hammersmith Bridge, which is not too far away from me. Mm. Fortunately, I don't have to cross the river, but it's a wooden bridge. So it's collapsed or they think it might collapse. So they're living. It's going to take 6 years to rebuild. If we're in China, that's probably a bad example at the moment to use China. But we would just go, right, it was a lovely bridge. It served its purpose. Now let's knock it down. And within 2 or 3 months, build something new and modern and nice. But we're so obsessed with old stuff that we're going to try and repair it. It's absolutely insane. And this is what we keep doing with our houses. And I don't know, I did a documentary years ago, a little series, and you were on it.
Yeah.
And one of the guys there was talking about houses which can be renewed. And to stop becoming so obsessed with a house is going to last 200 or 300 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, let's be honest, most modern houses will not last 200 or 300 years. They're just not built to the same sort of, you know, sort of standard and scale. But you know, you can retrofit. I've just spent about £300 with an organization called Carbon Co-op. They came round fully socially distanced during lockdown, and they've analyzed the whole house. They've worked out, you know, where I'm losing all my energy, looked at all the heat losses and everything else, and they've given me like a sort of 60, more like 80 page probably report on everything I need to do to make my house effectively modern standard. And although it's a lot of money, I mean, you're talking about, I don't know, I live in, my house is 140 years old. It's very leaky, like yours. It's a semi, four floors. So it's a, but it's about 50, 60 grand to make my house, you know, pretty, you know, not quite perfect, but really good from an energy perspective. I mean, you know, we're starting on that process. If you hear some knocks and bangs in the background, you know, that's the builders, you know, sorting out a leak and putting in two very energy efficient windows, replacing some old ones. You know, it's going to take some time to get to that point, but we can get there. We can retrofit.
It's a lot of money though, Tom. Everyone looks at 40 to 60 grand and think that's a lot of holidays. And yeah. You know, and when this pandemic's over, that's what everyone's going to be doing.
But that's why it's a great, you know, it's a great example of places where you start to think about putting government money, where you borrow government money and make it back over the long term. You know, we've got targets. We've actually, one of the things I would praise our leadership for over the last few years has been fairly aggressive commitments to climate targets. You know, we're one of the countries that stuck with it. More countries are coming on board. Looks like the US is coming back on board under Biden. You know, borrow some money, you know, because the government can borrow money at ridiculously low rates, make it really attractive for house owners, homeowners, landlords to make those buildings any efficient. You're pushing money into the construction economy, which you make a load back in taxes. We bring our energy costs down. You know, everybody's happy in the long run.
Mm. I just want to talk to you about money, and I'm so out of my depth on this, right? So I know nothing about money, but I do know that I don't carry any change on me or any cash on me now at all. I've literally got none because there's just no point. And that's one of the big things which changed it in the pandemic. It sped it through. But it also occurred to me that now money is just a digital thing online now. And I follow a lot of smart chaps on social media in the world, and a lot of them are saying that cryptocurrency is now coming onto its own. It seems to be stabilizing. A lot of billionaires have invested in it. Mm. The dollar and the pound used to be the currency that the world was based on, and then it changed to the dollar. The dollar's weakening in that thought process, and the cryptocurrency is growing. Are we moving towards that?
Look, the underlying idea of cryptocurrency has always been a good one, right? You know, the friction of moving money around was too high. We're increasingly a global economy, not a national economy. And so sort of one digital platform where you can move money easily around between places was kind of a great idea. The problem's always been in the execution. You know, I mean, they had the volatility you talked about, the energy costs. I mean, just coming back to that theme, you know, the energy costs of Bitcoin transactions were enormous, like way more expensive than moving sort of pounds and pence through the Visa or MasterCard networks or through the traditional sort of interbank networks. And so that execution was always a problem.
Why energy? What's it? Well, it's just a digital code, isn't it?
No, the way that cryptocurrency works, the way that you effectively generate coins, because it has this algorithm for effectively generating new currencies by solving cryptographic problems. So it was set up so that to control the supply of money into the system. The solving of those cryptographic puzzles is incredibly energy intensive. And so you had people building huge server farms next to, you know, sort of dams and waterfalls or using geothermal energy to try and process these puzzles. Excuse me. To the point where I think at one point, like the Bitcoin network was consuming more electricity than Sweden. You know, it's an incredible amount of energy it was consuming. And so if you're going to have a cryptocurrency, one that is secure, you have to have that cryptography, and you have to try and take a balance between making it, you know, efficient so that the transactions don't cost very much, and making it secure. And then, you know, that's always going to be a challenge, even as computers get more efficient and more stable. There's also the issue with cryptocurrency, and this is a very techie issue, that there's the possibility, and this is not yet proven, but the new type of computing, quantum computing, could shatter the cryptography that underlies the security of cryptocurrency. And so if you can break that cryptography, the whole network falls apart. And that's, you know, it's a very theoretical problem at the moment. You know, it's not proven. Quantum computers are still in their early stages, but they're moving very, very fast. No one knows yet if they will be able to shatter that cryptography, but if they can, it's not just cryptocurrency that falls apart, then it's all sorts of secure communications. Everyone from banks to spy agencies to e-commerce vendors is in massive amounts of trouble at that point.
The one thing that I've talked to you about this before, and you just saying that has made me think about it even more. We've got to start looking at global everything, haven't we? Global economy, you mentioned there. We've got such a, well, we've got to look at global taxation, because if you look at Jeff Bezos, who's deciding not to pay tax in this country yet, was it £1,500 a day from the day that Jesus was born, you still wouldn't be as rich as him. I mean, it's like ludicrous that someone's hoarding that much money, and yet he's offering a great service, but that money could, there's enough money in the world, isn't there, for us all to have great lives in every country, and there's an, we're generating enough of everything. But so that's a global economy, but also I'm thinking about data. This, we're using more and more data every year, aren't we? Even now, Zoom calls, I'm sure this is using a lot of data for us to be doing this. These data farms that you're talking about, how are we getting really good at compressing data? I'm again so out of my depth here, Tom. but as I understand it, there's these centers in deserts in America and places like that with armed guards and everything. But our data has to happen somewhere. I literally don't know where it is. We're going to run out eventually.
Yeah, we used to call them computer hotels, 20 years ago, when I was taking journalists on tours of them in the middle of the dot-com boom, internet hotels. And they're literally that. They're big, secure buildings. And in some cases, I mean, my favorite thing about them was that some of them are actually shock mounted. So it's a building within a building, and the building in the middle is on stilts, like rubber stilts, so that if there is an earthquake, it doesn't shake all the computers around. They're deliberately built outside of flight lines in case an aircraft crashes on them. They have multiple power supplies. They usually have a bank of diesel generators out the back and a whole room full of batteries to keep them running if the power goes down. They have multiple fiber optic lines. They usually have a satellite dish on the roof. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of these things around the world powering the internet. They consume an enormous amount of energy. We're not going to run out because of this thing's called, well, both Moore's Law and its parallels. So rewind 50 years, Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, noticed that the number of transistors you could economically fit on a silicon chip, I'm holding one in my hand, but you can't see that if you're listening, doubles every 2 years. So the bang for buck you get out of a computer doubles every 2 years. And despite us hitting, sort of bumping up against the limits of physics, that has remained true. And not only is the amount of processing power you can get for a pound doubled every 2 years, the amount of bandwidth, so how fast you can shuffle data about, has doubled for a pound, has doubled roughly every 2 years, and the amount you can store for a pound has doubled roughly every 2 years. And so we're still kind of on that curve right now. We're bumping up against the sort of the limits of physics, the way that we now construct microchips on what's called a 7-nanometer process, which, I can't remember the heuristics, the rule of thumb for this, but let's just say it's really, really small. Like, you're getting down to the point where an atom is not a lot bigger. Or not a lot smaller, rather. So, atoms start to move around, electrons start to behave really weirdly when you get down to that size. But all that means is we'll move to a different sort of technology that doesn't have those limitations before too long, like the quantum computing I just talked about. So I don't think we're going to run out of storage. It's more a question of what we do with it. Like, how useful really is all this stuff we're storing? It's a bit like your thing about old houses. Like, is it really important to know what I bought on Amazon or eBay 5 years ago? Does that really add any value to anybody? I mean, frankly, you could argue that some of my blog posts from 2006 are probably just cluttering up the internet and really don't need to be there. And so we need to have this conversation about what we're storing, why are we storing it? Does it affect our privacy, having this data in the hands of certain people? Who owns it? And frankly, for the sake of the world, should we be sort of Marie Kondoing our data histories and storing a bit less stuff?
Yeah, I wanted to do that with my social media, just get rid of everything from the past. There's apps which do it for you, as you know. But I was scared to do it, that people would think I was hiding something, and I'm not. And I was just like going, wow, people will just go, why is he doing that? Let's look into it. So I decided that I'd just leave it like everybody else does, just leave it up there. So
I mean, just like I say, the marginal cost of storing it now is so low that it's really not about actually the cost of it. Part it's about sort of the energy cost, and partly it's just about, does it add value? Does this data bring you joy, I think, as Kondo would say.
Yeah, I tell you, that's right. And I look at my email all the time, and because I just get served so many emails, it's such a I learned this at your conference, actually. Email was sort of like, you did a conference once, what was it called? It was great.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was all about people talking, discussing the future, and people were talking about email. And the only reason to have an email address was just to log on to something, because email was pretty pointless. It had become pretty pointless to a lot of the guys that were just talking at your conference. But I remember looking at my email now. I don't even bother deleting the ones. You know, they're just thousands and thousands of emails just clogging up my internet, but it's not clogging it up at all. They used to years ago, didn't they? Used to ask you to delete them.
Yeah.
Now they just sit there forever, don't they?
Yeah. It will just give you another terabyte of storage. It really doesn't. You know, it costs them so little,
right?
But it's just like, for the sake of keeping you as a customer and not annoying you, we'll just stick another hard disk in. You know, not that they're actually physically sticking a hard disk in, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, we'll go back to the internet in a minute, because there's so much to discuss on that, because it is changing our lives so dramatically. But let's talk about some stuff that might affect us. It's funny, I've noticed that where I live is just on the I live in London, but I live sort of in a sort of town just outside of London, West London sort of thing in London. But, you know, my high street has become really busy. It's one of the success stories of the pandemic. No, when I go into the West End, because I do all the time, or into the city, it's dead, literally dead. And I quite like cycling around there and stuff, because it's weird. It's very strange. It's like you're in some movie or something.
28 days later.
Yeah. But my high street seems to have done all right, because people are living at home now and they're not going into work. So it seems to be a little bit more buoyant. But the high street is changing dramatically, isn't it? And we are going to see a massive shift. And I'm sure the pandemic has helped it. One of my friends that I said who's closed down his business, he's just moved online. He closed it down and then just set up something else online, because he said there's no point in having a physical thing anymore. Rates are just too expensive, and he seems to be doing okay. And this more and more people are going to be doing this, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, the massive urban hubs, the Londons, the Manchesters, the Leeds, the city centres there, I actually think won't change that much, right? Because when the pandemic's over, you will have the footfall. There'll be some different brands there, but actually people will still go for sort of the shopping experience, or the meeting experience, or the eating and drinking experience. I think those big urban hubs won't actually change that much. It's more the sort of mid-size and smaller towns and cities, and particularly the suburban high streets, that are changing dramatically. Like, you know, small towns and cities are going to have to change radically. Like, they're not going to be able to support the retail footprint that they used to. That's gone. Like, something like 47% of retailers were in financial trouble before lockdown, like before the pandemic. I think that was the Grimsey Review beginning of last year. So it's no surprise that lots of them are gone, and more will go yet. And likewise, offices, like you say, more of us working from home. I don't think the office is dead. I think it is definitely going to change. I think the way we use the office is going to change. I think most people are working towards what they call a sort of, you know, hybrid approach, where some people are in the office, some people are out. But to do that, you have to change all your processes. You have to make sure that people who are working from home are not disadvantaged, that they've got access to all the same services and support. And, you know, once you do that, well, you go, well, why am I employing this person on, you know, 100 grand in London when I can employ someone on 50 grand in Prague, or, you know, even less perhaps in Chennai? So that's going to be really interesting next few years. But as you say, the suburban high streets, I think, are going to do really well. I think you're going to get lots of spaces for those people who want to work from home but not actually in their home. You know, they don't want to do the 2-hour commute to work, but they need a bit of space to work. So I think you see sort of evolutions of the coffee shop, and sort of, you know, somewhere between a coffee shop and a Regis building, a lot more of those the next few years. And all the services that go around that, food and drink, entertainment. But the centres of smaller towns and cities, they're going to see the most radical change. It's there that the retail footprint dies and is ripped out and replaced with something new, probably a lot of residential, I think, and all the amenities that go with that, schools, hospitals, doctors, surgeries, etc.
Interestingly, though, when you say these sort of Regency style office buildings with coffee shops, I do think there's something to be said for a lot of people who have spent their time getting themselves educated to be a lawyer or something. They don't want to then go, well, I've got all these, you know, all this experience, I'm a lawyer, I'm going to sit in a coffee shop type thing. They want the let's use Suits as an example, because people know that program. They want that office space, that luxury and stuff. So the top end surely must stay, because it's got a bit of snob appeal to it, hasn't it? It's got a bit of that where people think, well, I've achieved something, so I need a big office.
Yeah, absolutely. And it will stay. You'll still have the prestige. You'll still have the space. But, you know, take law firms, for example. You know, the suits type law firm is kind of a good example, right? You've got the big corner offices. You've got with their sort of their own PA and loads of space and the basketballs and the nice whiskey. But actually, most of the work and most of if law firms are honest, most of the revenue comes from the back office and all the juniors in their cubicle farm. And, you know, you go into a modern law firm in a lot of parts of the UK, and what you'll find is, you know, some very nice meeting suites and a few individual offices, and then tucked away massive cubicle farms full of, you know, relatively junior people doing large amounts of paperwork processing. Those jobs are going. Like, you know, at some point, sooner or later, those jobs go. You still need the posh office suites. You still need the senior person put their arm around your shoulder and give you the confidence that they know what they're talking about. But actually, most of the paper processing stuff in the background can be better done by an algorithm, can be better done by a bit of robotic process automation software. It's going to take time. It's not there yet. But I think, you know, the shape of organizations like that is going to start to look very different. And they may end up being literally, you know, the guy with the posh office and the personal assistant, you know, the human personal assistant to give you that sense of luxury and prestige. And behind them is not a cubicle farm. Behind them is a server farm.
Yeah. And I also think you need to, if you want to be creative in the creative industries, I think you need to sometimes, we're doing this over Zoom and it's great having this conversation, but we know for a fact, if we sat in a room, we wouldn't stop talking to each other like we do when we see each other, because it's just that human interaction just works a little bit better, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's I call it the bandwidth of being there, right? You know, there is such a richness when you're in the same room as that person. You're sharing the same smells, sharing food. You can both scribble on the same piece of paper. There's so much more depth to the communication than you can possibly replicate with current technology over, you know, even over a decent, you know, camera mic and screen that we're both sort of sitting on now. There's a lot lost in translation. And I think we're becoming more aware of that. You know, with the really interesting trends in lockdown, and again, it's an existing trend that's been amplified by what we've been through, is this craving for the physical, you know, this craving for richness and experience and the viscerality of the real world. You know, this half my friends are not shutting up about wild swimming, you know, which you know, a few people I knew were into sort of 18 months ago, and now like everyone's raving about, like hiking, like, you know, every weekend you're seeing, you know, photos. It's great actually for finding new places, because all your friends are out finding, you know, discovering some new part of the country with their, you know, and they're kitted out in all of sort of proper gear and marching off up hills and mountains. You know, I think that's going to be really interesting this year, as that sort of evolves. We go from wild swimming and hiking. I think adrenaline sports are due a comeback.
You know, yeah, I agree, and I think one of the good positives of this is how much people realize they enjoy getting out and about in nature. And when I used to be a swag man selling t-shirts with bands, I used to drive around Britain going, this is the most beautiful country ever. I mean, through Wales and Scotland and all through Northern Ireland, and then Ireland, which isn't Britain, but, you know, it's attached to it. And you go through everywhere and you just go, wow, look at this country. It's absolutely phenomenal. And it's a great playground. And I think people are starting to use it now. You just need the right clothes, as Billy Connolly always said, and you're fine. Let's move on to health, because that's interesting. I can combine two things here, because you started talking about algorithms and AI and then health. I think with the pandemic, we are all looking at our health. I went for a blood test recently and I was thinking, I really hope it's going to be put through a computer, because if it gets put through a computer, then I'm going to get better results than a human doing it. And I've actually, I suddenly thought that thought process hit me where I was like, hold on, I want to rely on a computer more. So I've shifted. When I'm looking at a doctor, I'm thinking, what do you know about it? Take a picture of it and put it in a computer. You know what I mean? I want to know what's really happening. I want a sample of 10 million or 2 billion people, not just you and your knowledge from this, you know, this doctor surgery. We're moving that way, aren't we?
Oh, undoubtedly. And I think we have to as well. You know, we know we've got an aging population, and a fascinating study out of the University of Washington last year said that actually the global population is aging faster than we thought and shrinking faster than we thought. So actually the sort of turning point, the tipping point for our population is kind of mid-century, this century. You know, it's going to start to decline again and shrink, which means that as the population shrinks, that means it's getting older and older. And so we've got this really big challenge coming up with, you know, both the economic challenge in terms of pensions, et cetera, but also the health challenge. You know, how do we keep people enjoying life, having productive lives, you know, both economically and socially later in life? We try and keep them healthy. And well, how do you do that? The worst thing you can do is try and intervene at the point where it's acute, where there's already an issue. What you want to be doing is collecting loads of data about someone's health, feeding it through a computer and saying, and looking for the earliest possible signs that something's wrong, and intervening at that point and making, whether it's your behavioral changes, lifestyle changes, diet changes, exercise changes, more of those hikes and wild swims. You know, you need to be doing that as early as possible and as cheaply as possible. And I think that's, it's quite a big, it's a difficult cultural shift. You were all quite protective of our own privacy, of our own health. We don't really want to be, you know, to be something to be scanning our blood, you know, everything else that's coming out of us on a daily basis. But actually, if we want to live long, you know, live healthily, live long and prosper, you know, then we're going to have to start to subscribe to that before too long, I think. And the only way to do it, certainly in the UK, is it was in a fairly public health fashion.
I did a food trial a couple of years ago, and I had to take my bloods every day. I had to give them feces and saliva, and they came up with what foods I can eat and what foods make my blood sugar spike and things like that. I loved it. And, you know, I'd signed a thing saying they could analyze it, and then they weren't good. There was all data protection and stuff around it. But I was like, I don't care about this. I'm going to find out what I can eat. and it's helped. It really has. And I was lucky enough to do it, but I try and put myself on these trials all the time because I quite like it. But I find them interesting. But that's got to be the future, where we sort of start looking at what we're all eating and what we're and how we're living our lives. And, you know, just the idea that you give blood every now and then, it's not a problem. The other thing which has happened is the doctors have started phoning and using Zoom, which we should have been doing this ages ago. It's going to move that way, isn't it?
Definitely. You know, I always used to rave about my doctor. She's sadly moved on from our practice now. But she and I had a great relationship. So I'm asthmatic. I've been hospitalized a few times. And you get to understand your own body. So we got to the point where I'd have a conversation with her. I'd just ring her up and say, look, here's my peak flow. These are the symptoms. I know I need antibiotics. Can you send me a prescription, please? And she'd say, yep, I agree with your diagnosis. Your wife can pick your script up, you know, in half an hour. And I'm like, I was sitting there going, why isn't every relationship like this? Well, the answer is not everyone is, in her words, quite as responsible a patient as you are.
Yeah.
You know, I put the effort into managing my health like you. I'm interested in it. I don't do as much exercise and I drink more than I should. But, you know, in terms of my asthma, the thing that nearly killed me, that I'm very, very conscious about and conscientious about. And I think, you know, the way to get around that is that I think we're quite often unreliable narrators about our own health. You know, we particularly in the age of the internet, where we can disappear down a sort of Google spiral of potential symptoms and convince ourselves that we've got some sort of weird and wacky disease or everything is cancer. You know, I think the technology can be the mediator there. It gives us empirical evidence. It tells the doctors that they can trust what they're seeing. And so, you know, while I think there is an enormous importance to be put on trusting the patient's report of what's wrong with them, because it's quite often a signifier of other things, you can't just have a relationship between us and a machine. That doesn't solve the problem. You still need the human being in the middle. But backing up that human being with the diagnostic capabilities of all of modern medicine, I think that's really powerful.
We're going to go off now in a little bit. I've got two ways to go here. I'm either going to go down food because of health, because you were just discussing it, or I'm going to go back to the internet because of something you just said there, how much poor information is out there, how much fake news and conspiracy theories. Is Tim Berners-Lee in the future going to be the biggest villain we've ever had? I keep thinking we're going to look back. We're not going to go. I keep saying this. It's not going to be Boris Johnson, and it's not going to be Trump. It's not going to be Brexit. I mean, the pandemic, I think, will be interesting in history, but it'll be the internet and how much it's changing the world. We all know the print press changed the world dramatically. We all know radio didn't. It gave dictators the ability to communicate with the people en masse. But the internet is just, it's something else. I became very aware that I go on the internet and I get influenced. I was going to say radicalized, but that's a bit too harsh, but influenced constantly. And I can sit there and I can read something on Brexit and go, oh, what have we done? And then read something else and go, oh, thank God we're out. Like in the space of half an hour. And it's like, and I'm not stupid, but I try not to be in an echo chamber, but I'm sure I am of some description. It's the internet and it's information spread. It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's what the trouble for me is the lag between the change in the sort of communication media. And the internet, you stripped all friction from communication. Anybody can say anything to everybody, and that is an incredibly powerful thing. But the problem is the lag between that and the shift in our faculties to be able to digest it and process it and deal with it. And there are lots of different ways that could go. We could rely on education. We could try and teach people to be better sort of moderators of fact and more curious and more skeptical. Or actually we could have a sort of editorial service. We could have, in some states that's going to be government mandated. It's, the Chinese state has the Great Firewall of China and they mandate what is true and what isn't. It could be a private service. So I've just been reading the latest book by Neal Stephenson called Fall, where, all wealthy people certainly pay for editors. If you can afford it, a human one, if not an algorithmic one, who basically curates your information feed and shows you either stuff that's true or stuff that you agree with, depending on which way you want to go. The result being that, some people are, seem to be relatively well informed, and some people choose to disappear into completely, sort of lost bubbles of humanity, where they believe in the sort of, the return of an armed Jesus. There are lots of different ways this could go.
Yeah, I just worry. I worry about a lot, and freedom is one of the things I worry about. We are free in this country. Excuse me. And then not so long ago, we arrested protesters for saying that that the coronavirus is a hoax. Actually, Prue Leaf got her vaccination, and I went online and read what people were saying. There was like three or four different conspiracy theories after she'd done it, telling her she was stupid. This is amazing, this information. But I can't remember his name now. Jeremy Corbyn's brother goes and starts. Piers Corbyn goes and starts telling everyone they're injecting us with, Bill Gates is controlling us, or whatever it is, or 5G and all that stuff. But what I found frustrating was we started arresting people. There's only 200 or 300 people there, and we started arresting them. And I thought, what if they are right? I mean, look, I don't think they are, but what if they are right? You can't start arresting protesters who don't believe in what you believe when you're keeping Robert Dias open. To me, it seems crazy that these people are not allowed to have a voice, but their voices are being amplified on the internet. And whilst what was scary about this is whilst they were doing that in London, it was the same thing was happening in Australia, in Berlin, in Austria. It was like all these different countries were doing the same thing, because you can spread that, the virus of the mind, it might be worse than the virus, the coronavirus. Who knows where we're going with this. And just finally on this, what's very interesting is in Germany, I haven't researched this well enough, but I have seen some of the pictures. In Eastern Germany, they're protesting in tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, about being locked down. Whereas in Western Germany, they're not, because the Eastern Germanies remember what it's like not to have your freedom. So they're worried about it. So it's a very interesting world we're living in at the moment. And I think we've got to allow people to have these ideas, but these ideas, we're all getting corrupted by going on the internet.
Yeah, I think you've always got to, it's always a fine line, isn't it? You can have, ultimately, there is a sort of government by consensus, right? If everybody sort of demurs, or enough people do, then things change. But while there is a sort of consensus there that says, okay, we believe in the virus, we believe this is what's happening, then by all means protest. Read what you want to read, believe what you want to believe, protest by all means. But when those protests cross over into doing things that potentially put other people at risk, then you have to do something about it. The problem is, as you say, when you get the logical inconsistencies of keeping the shops open, or having insufficient, keeping the schools open or whatever it may be, and then shutting down protests, that gets really problematic.
Yeah, you can't have, you're allowed to have a facial, but you're not allowed to protest. That's where I think it's bullshit. I'm sorry. And I don't see, there's no justification for that. You either lock down the airports, lock down everything, and then say you're not allowed to protest. I get that. But you can't have, you know, as no. I say, someone and buying a kettle and someone else not allowed to say, I don't believe in the government. You know, it's bullshit.
And I agree. I think the sort of logical inconsistencies have been one of the worst traits of our response, of our national response to this.
And can I just underline that? Because then you have journalists going, these people are disgusting. And then you have them going, put them in prison. And you're like, hold on. Why are you putting them in prison when they clearly have gone online and read stuff, and the evidence is there for them, not for us, but for them, they're reading it. And I know, because I could read that evidence and come to the same conclusions. It doesn't make them bad people. Who's in charge of the information? We're getting to George Orwell territory, aren't we? And we're the pandemic is really showing us that, isn't it?
Well, I think it's also showing us, like, why do we have so many people who are willing to go down that route, and, you know, comfortable going down that route, and more trusting of, you know, internet conspiracy theories than government or experts, whoever it may be. Excuse me. You know, why do we have that? You know, the reason is that we've done a lot to, you know, shed trust in those institutions that we used to have a lot more faith in. I think we've lost a lot of trust in government. We lost a lot of trust in sort of national media. And I think there should be a wake up call that, you know, maybe it's too late to restore that, but we need to find new mechanisms for conveying what we can trust and what we can't, for giving people faith back, you know, in some of these sources, and giving, if we can't, I think it's really difficult to teach people skepticism. You know, my ideal situation is that we have all of these sort of individuals empowered with the powers of skeptical inquiry, and who can come to, you know, who have a faith in science, and, you know, come to, you know, in my ideal world, the same conclusions I do, although, you know, some people might question that. But if we can't do that, the proxy for that has always been, you know, institutions that we believe we have affinity to and we can have faith in, whether it was the church or whether it was the government or whether it was our particular chosen newspaper. And once we undermine the faith in those things, once that faith is diminished and destroyed, it's very, very hard to get back. And we either have to look at trying to restore it or look at what the alternatives are going to be. What are the new institutions going to be that people can trust in, that carry people in the right directions?
Okay, I suppose in this country, just Tony Blair, weapons of mass destruction, Boris Johnson is constantly, Dominic Cummings. I mean, we're struggling to trust anyone, aren't they? So as soon as anyone says anything, we're thinking, oh, hold on a second, is this true? Or are you doing this because you're trying to manipulate the people? And you've got the side of people who are going, no, it's fine for them to lie to us, to manipulate. I think we should be looking at prison sentences for politicians who lie to us. I really do. I think it should be that, you know, when Michael Gove had to go on TV and I got a laugh at this. I'm sorry. I don't hate any of the politicians, but having been around a few politicians, I realize it's just a stupid power game that they're involved in. And their team is Tory or their team is Labour, you know, it's Conservative or Labour. And he was asked on this program, or I don't know, morning TV or something, they said, and I felt so sorry for him, because they said, after Dominic Cummings, he had to stick up for his teammate. And they went, would you get in a car and drive to test your eyesight? And he goes, well, yeah, on occasions. He literally couldn't get the words out because he's thinking, not a fucking chance can I do that. My wife is, and he just kept going around and then started laughing because he realized how ludicrous it was that he was trying to stick up for someone who got in a car to test their driver eyesight. I mean, it's just incredible.
But it comes back to this ideal, isn't it, right? What is our ideal? Our ideal is that politicians are a bunch of individuals who, you know, who use their own minds and their own judgment and their own experience to come to what they believe is the right conclusion, and the consensus of the commons, you know, takes us in, you know, what the majority of us can believe is the right direction. We are a million miles from that situation. We are in an age, we've always been an age of tribal politics where power is more important. You know, it's who's driving is more important than the direction we're traveling. You know, that's what it feels a lot of the time. I don't care where we're going as long as I'm the one with the remote control or the steering wheel.
That's it. 100%.
That's a dreadful situation to be in.
I was very good friends once with a Labour MP. I won't say which one, but he was saying to me he preferred being in opposition I was like, why? And he said, because at least I could hammer the Tories. Now I've got to stick up for policies that I don't believe in. And this was during the Blair era. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And he goes, because you're whipped into action to follow the line of something you don't believe in. I mean, it's crazy because I think all politicians get in for the right reasons, don't they? They all start by going, I'm going to make a difference in this country or the world. And then suddenly they realize they're just involved in a power game and all they've got to do is slag off the opposition constantly. Right, let's move it on to something a bit more fun. Well, I say fun, but it's, it's the internet thing. Let's talk about food because I think this has got really interesting recently. On my show, Sunday Brunch, which you know well, you come on, it's changed to... Yeah, basically most people eating most things, some people going, I don't like the texture, or I don't really like vegetables. It was sort of more that years ago, and now it's moved to literally we get a list every week of all the celebrities or everyone who's coming on and what their food preferences are, and it's sort of, you know, it's vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, low carb, you know, it's like this massive different information they're getting about what's healthy and what's right for them. And it seems to be moving still that way. I mean, I think we're in the middle of, I don't even know how to say this, veganary, is that what they're calling it?
Veganuary.
It shouldn't be vegan anyway, because it's vegetable. It should be vegan. I'll keep saying this. It's vegetarian, vegetable, vegan. How's it changed to vegan? Anyway, what do you think? What's happening with food?
Look, it's going to keep going in the same direction. I think you get this weird conflict. Like, I love the idea, and I think sort of a lot of the vegan campaigners believe that people are going vegan because suddenly they have this sort of deep passion for the environment or for animals, and completely ignoring the fact that, you know, when I remember hearing a long conversation about 4 years ago listening to One Extra or something. You know, on this sort of 10-minute conversation on One Extra about veganism, I'm thinking this thing's just ridiculous. This thing is gone huge. If this is a topic of conversation on a music, you know, on a youth music station, it's clearly going to get bigger and bigger. And so it is. Like, why are people going vegan? Because the celebrities they follow are going vegan, because their peers are going vegan, because they think it's going to improve their health, their fitness, their figure. And yeah, maybe because actually I don't really, you know, I'm not that interested in, or, you know, I do care about the animals. Or actually, do you know what? I think this is true for a lot of people. I've always eaten meat, but I don't really like the idea that it used to be an animal. Like, the number of people I know who will only eat chicken if it comes breaded in, you know, if it comes breaded in a packet from the freezer, and couldn't contemplate actually butchering a chicken themselves. You know, won't eat anything with bones in, won't eat any offal, just, you know, meat that doesn't look like meat, basically.
Well, Tom, let me just come in there, because it's what I'm noticing more in on Sunday Brunch is the more the meat Simon uses to cook looks like the animal, the more we're looking at it going, should that be on TV? And it's really strange, because we should be going, this is what it looks like.
Yeah,
but we're getting further and further away from being able to show meat on TV. It's weird. And we have the woman who comes on and she holds up fish. She comes from the fish markets, Billingsgate, and she holds up a whole fish, and always the celebrities go, we're about to taste a fish, and you're holding up what it actually looked like before it was, you know, it's become shocking for people to actually see what it looked like before you eat it. It's becoming weird.
But yeah, I think sort of 5-6 decades of processed food has kind of done that. You know, it became the way we shopped. It became the way we ate. We got out of the habit of buying sort of whole animals or whole cuts of meat and butchering them ourselves, or, you know, at least filleting them ourselves in the case of fish. And we got into the habit of buying things prepared, and we sort of lost touch. We got abstracted away from the animal and then the fundamentals behind it. And as far as I'm concerned, if you can't, you know, look that animal in the eye and go, I'm going to eat you, if you can't get to grips with the fact that you are eating an animal, you should be vegan. you should be a vegetarian. Unless you are comfortable eating it and ideally eating every part of it, what are you doing eating the animal in the first place? You've got sort of, I don't think there's any sort of, you know, moral sense in that. Just stay away from it. Get away from it. Corn's all right, you know.
I think it's illegal in France to have your children as. Is it France where it's? I always make this stuff up. And then I think it's France. It's illegal to have children who are vegans. I think it is. I need to research that.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I might have believed that not that long ago, but I mean, you go to Paris or basically like, you know, Barcelona these days, where, you know, I remember going around Barcelona with my wife's been vegetarian most of her life, and we're going there with her, well, I don't know, 15 years ago, and trying to find a vegetarian, you know, place where we, not just a vegetarian restaurant, a place where we could get vegetarian food, like actual vegetarian food, not vegetables that are being cooked in animal fat or along, you know, something like that. And we found, I think we found two. I think we found two in Barcelona. And then you go back now and there's a vegan cafe on every corner. And you know, the same is true of France. You know, we had the same experience in Lyon. Like we found one Italian restaurant that had one, you know, just had basically spaghetti and tomatoes. And that was the one thing we could feed her sort of 15, 16 years ago. Whereas now there's vegetarian food everywhere.
What I find so strange about it, again, it's the tribalism of it. I'm a carnivore, you get online now, and all you get, I'm a vegan or I'm this or I'm that. And, you know, when I was at school, I was told I was an omnivore. And I'm wondering whether it's going to change because people keep saying we're not supposed to eat meat or we're not supposed to eat this or something else. And it's a strange thing. Just on this, though, when I did those mini documentaries, the one that I like most, I think, was obviously yours, Tom, but the one I really liked was the one which we talked about lab-made meat, you know, artificial meat. Because I interviewed the guy who'd made the £100,000 burger or whatever it was. The you know, that price of that meat stuff is coming down dramatically now, especially fish. But I said to him, why are you doing this? And he said, well, we're doing it because of animal welfare. It wasn't because they were trying to invent something, a new sort of protein. They just thought we wouldn't want to kill animals in the future. So the way it works, as you know, for anyone who's listening to this, they take cells of, I think they got beef, which was hard to do. And I think fish and chicken is easier. And they take it and then they grow it in a lab and then they make it for you. And this is starting to arrive on our shelves, isn't it, now, our supermarkets?
It's still expensive. The culturing process, I think, is still quite energy intensive. But, you know, making beef is energy intensive, right? It's an incredibly inefficient process. Water intensive as well. That's the thing people always forget about. It's not just the feed. It's the amount of water it consumes to make these things. And so we know there has to be more efficient ways to do it. I think the question I have is, you know, how long are we going to want these meat alternatives? How long, once we start creating stuff in the lab, how long are we going to want stuff that tastes familiar, that tastes like the thing we knew? And how long before we start creating something completely different, like a completely new form of protein that has no sort of historical analog, no sort of meat or grain-based analog? It's completely new food.
Well, the new theory is, and the one is, why not make it out of you? So take a Tom Cheesewright cell, take yourself to the laboratory and reproduce yourself to eat.
I am the new Wagyu beef. I can promise you I've been well marinated in whiskey.
You need to exercise more to get rid of the fat, but that could happen, you know, a bit of Tom Cheesewright with a bit of sauce on it. All right, there's a couple of things I want to get through before we get to the end. The first one is robots. I watch Boston Dynamics all the time. Is it brilliant or is it scary as shit? Because I can't make up my mind. For anyone who doesn't know, Boston Dynamics is when they come round as viral things, don't they, all the time? With the one over Christmas was the dancing robots where they were actually all dancing, or they do gymnastics. There's dog ones which run around. It's Boston Dynamics. Look at it if you don't know. It's incredible what these robots are doing now. Scary or brilliant?
Both. I mean, I don't think we should choose between the two. The fact that we've gone from just a few years ago struggling to make a robot that could, you know, walk over a brick, that we can now make ones that can dance up and down stairs, is quite an incredible rate of progress. I mean, I think you always have to take those videos with a pinch of salt. You know, I'd love to see the outtakes videos from those. A bit like you get at the end of the DVD, you know, the other 4 days where the thing kept smacking into walls or punching each other in the face. A bit like the robots in Short Circuit, you know, where he reprograms them to do the three Stooges. I'm sure there was a few scenes like that. But, you know, it's scary because, you know, someone said to me on Twitter the other day, the first thing these things are going to be used for is you're going to put a weapon in their hand.
Well, I was going to say that to you. The three things we're going to use them for is, I interviewed a couple of SAS guys Special Forces guys on this podcast, and they one of them said towards the end of his career, they weren't doing as much because drones were doing it all for them. So we know that's going to happen. So they can send robots in to fight, and you know 100% they're going to be used for that because, you know, as soon as America can get their hands on those, and we'll do the same, we'll be going, let's put them in there. The other thing is, we're going to use them for delivery, aren't we? Because, you know, I hate to say this, Tom, the other day I needed a light bulb and I thought I'll just go onto Amazon and do it, and I hated myself for it. I eventually bought a pack of 10 because I needed one, because I felt so guilty about the idea, and it arrives the next morning and we're doing more and more of that. So the idea that we can get robots to do that. And the third thing is, which I know you've discussed before, is we're going to want to have sex with them because if they can start looking like men or women or whatever we want to have sex with, it might happen. What do we think?
It's a thriving trade already. I don't think they replace human relationships. I think, you know, we were talking about that sort of that reconnection with nature through lockdown. And I think the same thing is going on in some ways with our reconnection with other human beings. I think we're starting to prize that all the more we're deprived of it. We're going to see the massive collapse in the birth rate at the, 2020 and 2021. The US, one study predicted they're going to have 500,000 fewer kids as a result of lockdown. I think there's going to be a significant spike when it all lifts again as well. But I think maybe we might have 100,000 fewer kids if we're roughly on the same track. I think sex robots, definitely already a big niche, probably going to grow. Will they look like humans? Interesting question. In terms of deliveries, I think really the most interesting company in this is Starship, who are working with Co-op in the UK, and they've just expanded their trial. They were already running them in Milton Keynes. They've now expanded them to another load of stores in Northampton. These little roll-along drones that look a little like... do you ever have a big track when you were a kid?
Yeah, I've seen one on the street. I was in East London, and I saw one at Elephant Castle. I was around there, and one was coming along the street. I was like, what the hell's going on here? And it was trying to deliver something. It was a mental...
But, you're going to see a lot more of those in places where they make sense. Isles of Scilly, I've just heard they're expanding their use of flying drones to deliver stuff. Like, got to get stuff out from the mainland. Why send a boat when you can just send a drone? The scary thing is we already have robots fighting wars, albeit remote control ones. I think the scary bit is when they start to become autonomous. When they start to take decisions for themselves. I think there's a... That's perhaps a line we shouldn't cross.
Yeah, I know. It's scary. So I like the idea that we mesh with them, though. Think Alien, where we actually put on an exoskeleton. And if I go for a run, I can run at like 50 miles an hour or something. I hope I'm still alive to see that, so I can go for...
You certainly will be. You can now buy a very, very basic exoskeleton for about $13,000, which protects your back and allows you to work longer if you're in the construction trade. So you can lift more, you can hold the drill up for longer. The 13 grand to be Iron Man seems like a pretty good deal to me.
Going to the pub and pick a fight with someone. My brain's terrible, isn't it? Finally, because I want to keep this shy of an hour. We've got a couple more minutes just because I love it. And I, talk about the stuff I go on the internet and look at. I'm obsessed with going on and looking at aliens, UFOs, anything like that. That used to be a superpower, a super race of humans, which used to live here and we all got wiped out. And, that's who built the pyramids. I love all that stuff. And I love reading about it. There's more and more. Apparently last year there was more UFO spottings. But I think there was loads in the 60s or something, or the 50s, but that was the birth of film where they were talking about them. But we've come
a lot
back
of drugs
now.
Consumed as well.
There was that. That's what we were doing. We're all at home taking drugs or getting drunk, and they were like, hey, look, there's something in the sky. But aliens, what did you know anything? Are they here, Tom? Do you know? Have you heard on the grapevine?
So the big thing for me is like, how much life is there in the universe? Because if we can find signs of life, nearby, then that suggests that maybe the universe is teeming with life and that we have to work out why we've not come across it yet. And so the story last year that actually they may have found life in the atmosphere of Venus was really interesting to me. So they found phosphine, this element which, as far as we know, can only be made in a lab or by biological processes. We don't know of any labs on Venus. That would be a hell of a discovery. But so the idea that there may be some sort of biological life, however basic, on Venus, I think is fascinating, because if it's true, if it proves to be accurate, that suggests that there is a lot more life in the universe potentially than we've seen evidence of so far. The big thing for me with the UFOs and the aliens, though, is like, if there's so much of it around, there should be... It should be impossible to keep secret. It should be impossible to keep this under wraps. If there was that much life around that we were seeing all these UFOs, I feel like there'd be a lot more public evidence. That would have been impossible to keep it a secret in the age of the camera.
What if they're living in a different dimension? What if they, how dogs, or is it, what animal is it, that eagles or something, can see a different
different
spectrum of the light or something? What if they're working in that and so we can't see them?
many sort of many worlds theory, different dimensions, you know, all, you know, the fringes of physics. We're just pretty stupid at the moment. Like this, you know, the more we learn about the universe, the less, you know, the more we realize we just don't understand a thing, really. I think we're still primates, like scratching around in the dirt, basically.
100%. But this is why the internet is we can finish on this, because it's why it makes such a huge impact. Because I go on and I start reading about this and the aliens and everything and different dimensions and reptiles and whatever else I read. And whilst I'm reading it, I'm consumed and I believe every single bit of it. And I have to come away and go, give your head a wobble, Tim. Come on. Come on. Think about it. Because so that is the anti-vaxxers. That's the anti-corona. There's no coronavirus. The 5G mask. It's so easy to go and fool yourself. And that's why the internet is such a dangerous thing, as well as being such a beautiful thing.
I think there's a book in that, Tim. It's the Lovejoy head wobble. how to be a modern skeptic in the age of the conspiracy
theory. It's always brilliant to talk to you. I absolutely love it. And well, let's do it again soon, because it's
definitely
always fun, isn't
definitely
it? Cheers, mate. Thank you so much. Tim.